Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Babbel, speak a new language with confidence. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian and German. Babbel is designed to quickly get you speaking your new language within weeks, and their convenient lessons are only 10 to 15 minutes each. Lessons are lovingly created by over 100 language experts, not by a translation machine. Babbel is available as an app or online, and your progress will be synced across all devices. Here are the easy steps to speak a new language with confidence. Download the app or go to babbel.com. Select the language of your choice and try it for free. That's Babbel, BABBEL.com. Babbel, speak a new language with confidence.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 3rd of October, these are our main stories. The row between U.S. Democrats and President Trump over their impeachment proceedings against him has deepened. Stock markets in the United States have closed down sharply following big losses in Europe, prompted by signs of weakening economic growth. Top prison officials in Colombia have been forced to quit after a jailed politician escaped during a visit to the dentist. Also in this podcast...
His music was slow, melancholic and sad, but in Gia Cancelli's own words, he had a happy life.
Georgia is mourning the composer Gia Cancelli, who's died at the age of 84. President Trump has escalated his verbal attacks on Democrats leading the impeachment inquiry against him as they warned that additional charges could be brought. Mr. Trump had this to say to reporters in the Oval Office about Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, and his understanding of a call which President Trump made to his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky.
He made it up, every word of it, made up, and read to Congress as though I said it. And I'll tell you what, he should be forced to resign from Congress. Adam Schiff, he's a lowlife. He should be forced to resign.
Democrats say they will subpoena the White House for key documents related to the phone call. Mr. Schiff warned against any attempts to block the release or hinder the investigation.
We want to make it abundantly clear that any effort by the president or anyone else to interfere with the Congress's ability to call before it relevant witnesses will be considered as evidence of obstruction of the lawful functions of Congress.
Democrats are still chasing key documents related to the phone call. They're threatening another impeachment charge if they don't get them. I spoke to our White House correspondent, Chris Buckler, who's in Washington, and asked him, how are Mr. Trump's comments being received?
What was very clear from President Trump today as he stood alongside the Finnish president to give a news conference is that he's becoming very, very tired of the constant talk of potential impeachment and the many questions about his request that the Ukrainian government investigate his political rival, Joe Biden. At one stage, a reporter got into a bizarre argument with President Trump, where essentially President Trump said, stop asking me questions, start asking the Finnish president questions. But he is certainly trying to fight back. What you saw today was a furious attack on Democrats who have claimed wasting their time on what he called something I can't describe on Twitter, but essentially something that he believes does not stand up. And as you mentioned there, he started name-calling with one of the party's leading congressmen, Adam Schiff, a man who has been really spearheading this attempt to launch inquiries into impeachment, calling him a fraud, amongst other things.
Meanwhile, there was a very different tone at the Capitol, where Nancy Pelosi held a press conference just before that one with Adam Schiff himself, where she was saying there was a need to be restrained and for people to kind of really do a thorough investigation. So what's next for this inquiry?
Yeah, so there are a number of things happening. And what you're seeing from the Democrats is this real attempt to try and treat things carefully. They know that there is a danger that impeachment proceedings could backfire, that they could blow up in their face. But at the same time, they believe there are things to investigate here. And that work goes on to push for State Department officials, for example, to give evidence they feel feel that they are being obstructed in many cases by State Department officials, including the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, of trying to get information from them. But the work is beginning. For example, as you might remember, the envoy to the Ukraine, Kurt Volker, the American envoy who resigned as this whistleblower's complaint became common knowledge, he's going to give a deposition at Congress. And it gives you a sense that they want to try and get as much information as they can, despite that real frustration from Donald Trump.
Chris Buckler in Washington. As we record this podcast, stock markets around the world have tumbled on fears about the health of the global economy. In Britain, the FTSE index recorded its worst day in more than 3 years. The Dow Jones in New York was trading about 2% lower. Samira Hussein reports from New York.
On Wednesday, the main U.S. financial indices were all flashing red. Spooking investors was a report showing the private sector created fewer jobs last month than economists were expecting, stoking fears that a slowdown in the labor market may be just around the corner. And recent economic data showed that the manufacturing sector has hit lows not seen since the end of the financial crisis a decade ago. It is more evidence that the ongoing trade war between the U.S. and China is hurting American industry.
Samira Hussein. World Trade Organization arbitrators have cleared the way for the United States to impose tariffs on EU goods worth $7.5 billion. It's in response to state support for the European aerospace company Airbus that was deemed to be illegal. This year, the WTO found that four EU countries had failed to remove their subsidies for the aircraft maker. Imogen Folks reports from Geneva.
Wine, whiskey, brandy, handbags, designer clothes, and cheese all could be subject to tariffs following the WTO's ruling. The EU says it believes US tariffs on European goods would be short-sighted and counterproductive. But if they do happen, and the EU wants to respond, it won't have long to wait. The WTO also says Washington has been illegally subsidising its own aircraft manufacturer, Boeing. A decision on how much the EU can impose in tariffs on the US is expected early next year.
Imogen Folks in Geneva. European Union leaders have reacted cautiously to new Brexit proposals from Britain, which have been put forward less than a month before its planned departure from the bloc. The European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker said there were positive elements, but also problematic ones. The EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, said a lot of work still needed to be done to meet all the objectives of the EU's proposed so-called backstop, which aims to prevent the return to a hard border in Ireland. The new Brexit proposals mean that Northern Ireland would stay in the EU single market for all goods, accepting its rules and standards, but the region would not remain in the EU customs union, meaning it would benefit from any future trade deals negotiated by the UK. To get a clearer understanding, Tim Frank spoke to our political correspondent, Rob Watson, and in Dublin, Audrey Carville, an Irish journalist and presenter of Morning Ireland, the breakfast programme on the broadcaster RTE. He first asked Rob, is there any more detail on how this new proposal is going to work?
Not really. And I think that'll be the concern of the European Union and of course, the Irish government. And we'll hear more from Audrey. And, of course, I would say businesses in Northern Ireland, because I think the concern will be light touch customs, absolutely, but a lot of the technology that's been talked about, I think the critics would say, simply doesn't exist. And it also is going to rely on an awful lot of goodwill, that people won't be tempted to get into smuggling if there's no hard border. And yet you're going to have different trade policies, different tariffs, different taxes either side of the border.
Audrey, what's the view in Dublin?
The Taoiseach, the Prime Minister here, Leo Varadkar, spoke for about half an hour to Boris Johnson this evening. Afterwards, Mr. Varadkar, he said the proposals did not meet the agreed objectives of the backstop. So in other words, they do, despite what Boris Johnson says, they do create a border on the island of Ireland in direct contravention of the 1998 Good Friday Peace Agreement. And really, Tim, there is incredulity here that in an attempt to come up with a plan to avoid a hard border here, the British government has come up with a plan for two borders. One in the Irish Sea between Ireland, all of Ireland and Britain, and another one on the land border between north and south. And not only that, the plan to give one section of a divided community in Northern Ireland, that is the unionist community, the section of Northern Ireland who want to remain within the within the United Kingdom, to give them a veto over whether or not the entire region remains in parts of the single market. So really, as it stands, this proposal, it's a non-runner from this standpoint.
Right. And Audrey, is the Irish government confident that, in a sense, the EU has its backs on this? Because clearly there is also concern in the European Union about the prospect of there not being a deal with Britain and the effects of that. Do you think that they will stand foursquare with the Irish government over its concerns?
Well, they have done until now, Tim. I know we're a very suspicious lot over here as well. We keep waiting for that moment where the EU's solidarity with Ireland, which has been there for the last 3 years, starts to weaken and starts to fall away. But no, as far as Ireland is concerned and the Irish government is concerned, they are absolutely full square behind the Irish government's position. There's a united front here within political parties here as well, but also statements from Jean-Claude Juncker, from Guy Verhofstadt in Brussels this evening all indicate very, very strongly that they are as concerned about these proposals as the Irish government is.
Rob Watson, how confident would the government be that even if somehow compromise was found on the basis of this proposal to the European Union, that Boris Johnson could then get it through Parliament?
There's a huge if, obviously, to that first part of your sentence, Tim. If it could get past the European Union, and in particular the Irish government, but all of them. But then to move on to, well, it would be immensely difficult. I mean, let's remind ourselves that this is a minority government. I think many British politicians will be worried whether this really would be true to the Good Friday Agreement for the reasons that Audrey was just telling you about. So I think it would be a massive uphill struggle. And I think there'll be an awful lot of people, awful lot of politicians who are not pro-Brexit saying, do you know, this just looks like the worst of all worlds, this deal, that essentially Mr. Johnson is trying to have his cake and eat it. That is the Brexiteers' great promise during the referendum that, we were going to have an independent trade policy, but somehow do that without upsetting the Good Friday Agreement.
Our political correspondent Rob Watson, and before him, Audrey Carville from the Irish state broadcaster RTE. Iraqi security forces have clashed with anti-government protesters for a second day in Baghdad and a number of other cities. In all, 5 people have been killed in the unrest, including 2 in the southern city of Nasiriyah. Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston reports.
Police in Baghdad barred access to the city's central square and sealed off what's called the Green Zone, where government buildings are located. But protests erupted in other neighbourhoods across the capital. Tear gas has been used and shots fired. Reports have also come in of clashes in a string of big cities in the south. The demonstrators, who appear to lack any organised leadership, are angry about the very poor public services, joblessness, and the rampant corruption that plagues Iraq.
Alan Johnston, it sounds like something out of a heist movie, the escape through a dental clinic's window from several floors up by a female senator in Colombia. She'd been jailed last year for electoral fraud and the illegal possession of firearms. Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, told me what it's all about.
We know how amazing it was because it was caught on video. CCTV released by the Colombian police show this senator, Aida Merlano, sliding down a rope, more like a tape, like a towing tape, red tape, from the second floor of a building, a private clinic in a posh area of Bogota. She had gone for a teeth whitening session with a private dentist from jail, from a notorious prison in Bogota, to that jail. And she slides down, lands quite heavily in the middle of the street. Then, you know, some passers-by are concerned about her, say, oh, do you need any help? She said, no, I'm okay. And then she gets on a motorbike that was waiting for her, very carefully puts her helmet on and disappears.
So it's not only daring, it's incredibly well choreographed and planned. There must no doubt now be a major operation underway for her capture for the, because this must be terribly embarrassing for the Colombian
authorities. It is very embarrassing. And the government has sacked the head of the prison system and also sacked the director of the prison that released her to go to a dentist session and has put out an award for information leading to her arrest. So it's very embarrassing. She had been sentenced to 15 years in jail for electoral fraud, and the prosecutor said that she belonged to a mafia, political mafia in Barranquilla. And it's very concerning for the government. She was due to meet her lawyer for an appeal and didn't turn up for that. But her lawyer is going ahead with the appeal anyway. He thinks that won't put out, you know, that won't stop her appeal going ahead.
Leonardo Rocha. Also in the podcast.
There was a lump in my breast, which lasted for some time. I went to the hospital. It was diagnosed to be breast cancer.
We look at the rare condition of male breast cancer. Now to Turkey, and a vigil was held on Wednesday in Istanbul for the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered there a year ago. Mr. Khashoggi, a prominent critic of Saudi Arabia's government, was killed inside the kingdom's consulate in the Turkish city by a team of Saudi agents. A white memorial stone was unveiled in Mr. Khashoggi's memory. The BBC Arabic correspondent Hanan Razik reports from Istanbul.
1 year after the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi here inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, his fiancée, friends and a number of organizations came here today to unveil this white memorial stone that has his name, his date of birth and the date when he entered that building and never showed up. Powerful words we've been hearing from his fiancée, who is still calling to find out who made that order to kill Jamal Khashoggi last year, and other very powerful speeches by the UN Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard, who concluded in her independent investigation that Saudi government is responsible for this killing, and she's now calling for imposing sanctions on Riyadh. However, we understand that the Saudi investigations are still ongoing, with 11 people being charged. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who's been facing a storm since the killing of Khashoggi last year, has said that this happened under his watch. However, he denied any involvement or knowledge.
Hanan Razek in Istanbul. The journalist Jonathan Rugman has just published a book about the aftermath of the Khashoggi murder. He's foreign affairs correspondent for Channel 4 News here in the UK, and Paul Henley asked him if he had been surprised to see the diplomatic world move on so quickly after the killing.
It's certainly not being brushed under the carpet by his fiancée or by the Washington Post, who employed him, or by the Turks, who are still making rather vague demands about justice without quite knowing what justice looks like. But the fact remains that I think the international community has taken the decision that it is better to carry on with Saudi Arabia, that this man, the Crown Prince, is likely to rule the kingdom for the next 50 years or more. We know from the attacks on Saudi oil facilities how important Saudi Arabia's energy supply is. And we also know how important an arms buyer Saudi Arabia is. And I think the message from the international community is, don't do this again, rather than stand trial in an international court.
Because the facts of the murder are very clearly established, aren't they?
The facts of the murder are very clearly established from the transcripts of the conversations that took place inside the consulate that were bugged by Turkish intelligence. There's also obvious evidence of the fact that he walked into the consulate on CCTV camera. The Saudis went round trying to take all the footage and they forgot about a police booth outside the consulate, which had a recording inside it of this footage.
Which has become quite famous footage since.
The very last images of him walking in at 1:14 p.m. on the 2nd of October, yes. Aside from that, of course, there is the footage of the two private jets that flew from Riyadh, which had diplomatic clearance. And there is footage of the 15 members of the Saudi hit squad who were filmed inside Istanbul airport and indeed walking into the consulate that day.
And indeed, we have a very clear admission from Saudi Arabia that Jamal Khashoggi was murdered.
Yes, the Saudi government eventually said he was murdered. First of all, it said that he had left. Then it said he was killed in a fight. Then it said it was an accident. And finally, they said that the head of the hit squad had a plan to murder him. So that the accounts have changed, and there is no denial of the fact that these were government employees. Several of them were members of the Royal Guard. And although 15 flew to Saudi Arabia, only 11 are on trial in Riyadh, and none of the names of those people have been disclosed. And the diplomats who are allowed to observe that trial have had to agree to a vow of silence.
Now, very little of the detail of the murder would be known now by the international community were it not for Turkey choosing to release these tapes to selected individuals. And the details are out there. On the other hand, Turkey could have stopped at least the second plane of suspects leaving Turkey and Turkish airspace, couldn't it?
I think that's right. I mean, the fiancé, Hatice Cengiz, gave her police statement between 5 and 6 p.m. on the day of the murder. The first plane took off at some point after 6 p.m., so maybe you can say it was too quick to stop it. The second plane took off after 10 p.m., several hours later. And I think a decision was made that it was better to maintain relations with Saudi Arabia. I think the Turks were worried about their own diplomats in Riyadh and their safety. And I think perhaps they were also thinking long term about falling out with such an important country.
The journalist Jonathan Rugman, who has just published a book entitled The Killing in the Consulate. The Vatican has suspended two senior employees and three other members of staff following police raids on Tuesday. There's been no comment from the Vatican, but media reports suggest that investigators are examining multi-million dollar property deals in London. An Italian newspaper, L'Espresso, published what it said were further details of the police raids. Here's John McManus.
The newspaper has reproduced a handout to the Swiss guards who control the entrances to the Vatican, which contains the photos and details of five employees who are not to be admitted. Among them is Monsignor Mauro Carlino, the head of documentation at the Secretariat of State, which deals with Vatican governance and diplomacy, and Tommaso Di Ruzza, the director of the Financial Information Authority, which is responsible for combating money laundering and the financing of terrorism. The Vatican has refused to comment, but Pope Francis has long attempted to clean up the Holy See's finances.
John McManus. Going to the toilet in public is a common practice in rural India, but one that Prime Minister Narendra Modi is trying to crack down on by building millions of lavatories across the country. Speaking at an event to mark the 150th anniversary of Mahatma Gandhi's birth, Mr. Modi said that more than 100 million toilets have been installed. But is anyone actually using them? A recent BBC investigation suggested that not enough people were. Our South Asia editor, Jill McGivering, told me more about what Mr. Modi is trying to achieve.
Basically, he's invested a lot of money in trying to build more toilets. He argues, and it's not unreasonable to say, that about 40% of Indians had access to a proper toilet when he came to office. He's now saying everyone in rural areas has access to a proper toilet. Certainly, a lot more people do. The numbers are a bit tricky, possibly 80-90% of people. Very difficult to know. It becomes very anecdotal.
It sounds like such a big number of people didn't have access to toilets. How has this been received?
It's varied enormously. There's no doubt there are more toilets out there than there were. Some people have said that the focus has been too much on infrastructure. It's been actually getting physical brick toilets out there. But then there are issues about usage. For example, some people say they started to build the toilet, but the money comes to them from the local authorities in bits and pieces, in phases over maybe a year. And so they've got half a toilet, but it's not actually finished and usable yet. And then there are other people who say, you know what? Yes, we've got a toilet, but we don't like using it. You know, our forefathers have gone out into the fields. We think that's the right and natural thing to do, and that's not something we're planning to change.
But there are genuine hazards about having people going out into the field, say, in the dark.
Absolutely. I mean, of course, there's the obvious health and hygiene issue that you want waste to be properly treated and not just out there. There's a very big population and that's hazardous in terms of spreading disease. But there are also particular issues for schoolgirls. It's one of the main reasons that girls drop out of school when they start menstruating, if they don't have access to somewhere that's clean, not feel embarrassed. And women generally, it's been the practice that women tend to try to avoid defecating all day in the daylight hours. And you can imagine in the summer how long that is. Even if they're ill, it is hazardous. And there have been examples of young girls or women going out and being attacked, sexually assaulted, even murdered.
Our South Asia editor, Jill McGivering. Now to the United States and the issue of male breast cancer. Matthew Knowles, the father of pop stars Beyoncé and Solange, has been speaking about his diagnosis and battle with the condition in an interview with Good Morning America.
It is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and you decided this was the right time to share some news about your health.
What I want to share, Michael, is that I also am a survivor of breast cancer.
Just 2 months ago, Knowles noticed a small recurring dot of blood on his shirt.
And then I told my wife, and she says, you know what? I saw a dot of blood on the sheets. So I immediately went to my doctor. I got a mammogram, and then it was very clear that I had breast cancer.
When you get the diagnosis that, yes, you have breast cancer, what goes through your mind?
Of all the things I could get, why would I get this? From a man's perspective, I'm thinking, why me?
Less than 1% of all breast cancer cases develop in men, so it is quite rare. Divya Arya spoke to Moses Musonga, who lives in Kenya, and asked him, when did he first realize he had breast cancer?
There was a lump in my breast, which lasted for some time. And when I went to the hospital, it was diagnosed to be breast cancer.
And did you know that you had that condition? Did you ever, examine yourself? How did you think of going to the hospital?
There was a lump which was growing, which was growing, and then there was some fluid that was coming through the nipple. The breast was becoming bigger and bigger. So when I went to the hospital, finally, they diagnosed that it was breast cancer.
And is it common for doctors to find a patient such as yourself, or is it just understood to be a woman's disease?
It's understood to be a woman's disease. That is why it was difficult for the normal hospitals to diagnose it, because they didn't expect it to be breast cancer at all. So that's why it took time for the doctors to discover that it was breast cancer.
And was it easy for you to talk about your condition to family, friends, acquaintances?
There is no problem. There is no stigma at all. I talk to them, and they just wonder, because they don't expect men to have breast cancer.
Moses Musonga. Georgia is mourning the composer Giya Kanchali, who died at the age of 84 in his hometown, Tbilisi. Kanchali is the author of musical scores to dozens of famous Russian and Georgian films and many theater productions, but it was his symphonies and orchestral music that brought him international acclaim. Rehan Dimitri sent this report from Tbilisi.
His music was slow, melancholic, and sad, but in Giya Kanchali's own words, he had a happy life. His compositions were an integral part of Georgian cinema and theatre for decades. Born in 1935 in Tbilisi, Giya Kanchali composed scores to over 50 films, some of them Soviet-era blockbusters such as Mimi No. This song is known in every corner of what used to be the Soviet Union, but the composer himself was never fond of it. It was his classical pieces that brought him worldwide fame. Giya Kanchali left Georgia in the 1990s when it was embroiled in various conflicts and moved to Antwerp in Belgium, where he became resident composer for the Royal Flemish Philharmonic. He wrote 7 symphonies and dozens of orchestral pieces, chamber and choral operas. In his later life, he stopped traveling to Russia because he opposed Vladimir Putin's policy towards his native Georgia. The best moments for him were the seconds of silence in the music hall after the end of the performance of his pieces. That's when he knew that an invisible thread connected his music to the people.
Rehan Dimitri in Tbilisi on the death of the Georgian composer Giya Kanchali. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email, The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.